There are a number of international voices calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, including the United Nations, the World Health Organization, and more than 120 world leaders. While the Israeli government has blanketly refused, the strongest voices calling against a ceasefire haven't been Israeli.
We hear those calling for a ceasefire.
People who are calling for a ceasefire now do not understand Hamas.
Peace through weakness never works.
Israel doesn't need a ceasefire. It needs its allies to cease with the politics and deliver support now.
Well, I don't know how you could have a ceasefire, permanent ceasefire, with an organization like Hamas.
Ceasefire now. Simply leave Hamas in place.
So those who delight in the 1,400 Israeli deaths join that call for a regroup ceasefire.
What are the chances of a Gaza ceasefire?
None. No possibility.
Many of these voices have instead promoted myths about Gaza that undermine our understanding of the real situation on the ground, as well as the political and historical context of how the conflict reached the boiling point it's in now. Let's look at one example. You might have seen this interview with former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking on The View.
I've been to Gaza, and Gaza is a highly populated urban environment.
It's been shared widely as an excellent breakdown of the conflict in Gaza and why a ceasefire would be a mistake. But how accurate is what she's saying? And is it serving another purpose? Let's break down the points Clinton makes in the interview.
There was a ceasefire on October 6th that Hamas broke. It has consistently broken ceasefires over a number of years.
Is this actually true? There has been an ongoing cycle of violent escalations between Israel and Gaza over the last two decades. And since Israel implemented a siege on Gaza in 2007, Israeli army officials have long had a policy they called mowing the lawn, which ensured they would target Gaza with bombing campaigns every few years to take out new Hamas targets and leadership. The most serious of these happened in 2008, 2012, 2014, 2018, and 2021, during which a total of 6,000 Palestinians were killed. These attacks regularly targeted and destroyed vital infrastructure such as power plants and water treatment facilities. In each of these cases, Israel's government blamed Hamas rockets for sparking the escalations. But in each of these cases, there was always something else happening. In 2021, Hamas fired rockets in response to two things: the forced eviction of dozens of Palestinian families from the Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, and the raids by Israeli police on Al-Aqsa Mosque during the month of Ramadan. Israel responded with a 10-day aerial bombing campaign that killed 250 Palestinians in Gaza. In July of this year, Israel launched a military operation in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, which killed 18 Palestinians. That attack drew international condemnation, and while Hamas didn't officially respond, five rockets were intercepted by Israel's Iron Dome, which prompted another bombing campaign in Gaza. This time, no one was killed. Then, in September, Palestinians in Gaza began protesting at the barrier fence against the ongoing siege, as well as renewed escalations at Al-Aqsa Mosque. Israel's army launched a series of airstrikes in Gaza, saying it was responding to the use of, quote, incendiary balloons that had set fire to small plots of farmland. That escalation ended with an informal agreement between Egypt, Israel, Qatar, and Hamas on September 28th to end the protests in exchange for Israel easing economic sanctions on Gaza. But in the following week, tensions continued to escalate. Human Rights Watch says warning signs were blinking red in the lead up to the October 7th attack. Quote, a track record of unlawful attacks by Israeli armed forces and Palestinian armed groups, unprecedented repression and apartheid against Palestinians, dehumanizing rhetoric by Israeli officials, and glorification of attacks on civilians by Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups. These trends have been exacerbated by the absence of safeguards to restrain actors likely to commit atrocities. According to several reports, Egyptian intelligence had also warned Israel 2 days before October 7 that an explosion of the situation is coming. Both sides have a documented history of breaching ceasefire agreements, and each often cites their own reasons as to why. In the lead-up to Israel's ground invasion of Gaza in 2014, an Egyptian brokered ceasefire had been in place. That ceasefire was broken 266 times, 75 times by Palestinians and 191 times by Israel.
Israel has a right to defend itself, as any country would. Ukraine has a right to defend itself against an invasion, an unlawful, inhumane invasion by Russia.
The Ukraine comparison has been used by a number of people to justify Israel's military response. But there is one major difference. Ukraine is under military occupation by Russia, whereas Israel is the occupying power. Under international law, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, as well as Gaza, are under military occupation and have been since 1967.
What has been going on now for a number of years under Hamas rule is the building of over 200 miles of tunnels under Gaza, the storing of munitions, all kinds of explosives, under hospitals, under refugee camps, under civilian targets.
This part is particularly important because this is the justification Israel has used to target not only hospitals and refugee camps, but also schools, mosques, churches, and UN buildings, with devastating losses to civilian life. Hamas does, of course, have a network of tunnels that have been used to bypass the siege on Gaza. They're used to smuggle in weapons from the outside, but also medicine, building materials, livestock, and civilians. They've become a lifeline for Gaza's population and have been centered mostly around the areas bordering Israel and Egypt. Estimates range from anywhere between 100 kilometers to 500 kilometers of tunnels, but these are all based off of Israeli intelligence estimates and are unproven. There's also no real proof of where these tunnels actually lie, but the accusation by Israel's military that they run under hospitals has been repeatedly disproven.
A ceasefire done prematurely benefits those who do not abide by any laws, by any rules, by any human, you know, character value about the value of life.
So why are international voices calling for a ceasefire? That's because the situation in Gaza has become critical. Since October 7, more than 10,000 Palestinians have been killed, including more than 4,000 children. That number doesn't include thousands more trapped under the rubble of collapsed buildings who rescuers are unable to reach. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres described Gaza as a graveyard for children. When Israel's government cut off access to electricity, fuel, and water, it escalated the pressure on hospitals, the majority of whom have been abandoned because they can no longer run generators. Reporters in Gaza say there is a 3-day wait for water and food, which is rationed between people, some of whom have resorted to drinking seawater, which is deadly to humans. Half of the population of Gaza's 2.2 million have become displaced, pushed further south to areas that have also been targeted by airstrikes. Because of the blockade, they are unable to leave Gaza, and tens of thousands have been camping out at hospitals, where they hope they'll be safe from bombardment. 70,000 people are just at El Shifa Hospital alone. But with repeated warnings from Israel for these hospitals to be evacuated and the repeated accusations that hospitals are covering for Hamas tunnels, there is a real fear that they aren't safe there either. Who benefits from a ceasefire? Right now, it's the people of Gaza.
My husband, with the Israeli government at the time in 2000, offered a Palestinian state to the Palestinians. At that time, Arafat turned that down. There would have been a Palestinian state now for 23 years if he had not walked away from it.
So here, Clinton is talking about the Camp David summit in 2000, where the U.S. brokered negotiations between Yasser Arafat and Ehud Barak. It was meant to be a final status solution to the conflict. That had come 7 years after the Oslo Accords were signed, which too had promised the Palestinians a state within 5 years. But that hadn't happened. The Israeli Prime Minister who negotiated that deal, Yitzhak Rabin, was assassinated by a far-right ultra-Zionist 2 years later. At the Camp David summit, a number of key issues for Palestinians were rejected by Israel, including the right of return for Palestinian refugees, sovereignty over East Jerusalem and Al-Aqsa Mosque, and a return to pre-1967 borders. U.S. analysts who took part in those negotiations later wrote that the Palestinians had made many more concessions than the Israelis, including giving up 80% more territory than Israel was willing to offer. Polls at the time suggested 55% of Palestinians approved of Arafat's position on the agreement, while the majority of Israelis believed Ehud Barak had compromised too much. The talks fell through, in part because Barak's own coalition stood against it, and he was positioned to lose the next election to Ariel Sharon, who bolstered his popular support by leading a tour through Al-Aqsa Mosque, which sparked outrage among Palestinians and ignited the Second Intifada. In the aftermath of the talks, Barak blamed Arafat solely for the failed negotiations. And successive administrations of Sharon and Netanyahu would use this as proof the Palestinians did not want to make peace.
Israel left Gaza in 2005 and forcibly ejected 50,000 Israelis who were living in Gaza. They left all of their infrastructure. They had a big infrastructure of greenhouses where they were supplying fruits, vegetables, flowers, etc. Hamas came in and basically destroyed all of that.
Here's what's important to know about Gaza. From the 1967 Arab-Israeli War until 2005, Israel built a number of illegal settlements across the Strip, in violation of international law. The population of Gaza was placed under a crippling military occupation, with ongoing curfews and restrictions of movement similar to the current situation in the West Bank. In 2003, following the Second Intifada, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon proposed a policy of disengagement from Gaza, which involved dismantling 25 settlements and 9,000, not 50,000, Israeli settlers were relocated. Each was compensated $200,000. It was presented to the international community as a token of goodwill by Israel. However, it was sold to Israelis as something else. In 2004, Ariel Sharon's senior advisor, Dov Weisglass, told Haaretz newspaper, quote, "The significance of the disengagement plan is the freezing of the peace process. And when you freeze that process, you prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state. And you prevent discussions on the refugees, the borders, and Jerusalem." Effectively, this whole package called the Palestinian state, with all it entails, has been removed indefinitely from our agenda. And all this with authority and permission. All this with presidential blessing and the ratification of both houses of Congress. Following the disengagement, Sharon focused his attention on tightening control over East Jerusalem and the West Bank and rapidly escalated settlement construction. A year later, when Palestinian elections led to Hamas being voted into power, Israel imposed an air, sea, and land blockade on Gaza, cutting it off from all access to the outside world and creating what British Prime Minister David Cameron would later describe as the world's largest open-air prison. That blockade has continued to exist for 17 years. So why is Hillary Clinton, a former US Secretary of State and an expert on the Israel-Palestine conflict, promoting a number of inaccurate statements about Gaza, ones that happen to fall in line with Israel's own messaging? Well, let's take a look at Clinton's relationship with Israel. In 2016, during her election campaign against Donald Trump, Clinton gave a speech before AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, a lobby group that donates to U.S. electoral candidates.
The United States and Israel must be closer than ever, stronger than ever, and more determined than ever to prevail against our common adversaries and to advance our shared values. This relationship has always been stronger and deeper than the headlines might lead you to believe.
The AIPAC lobby's stated aim is to, quote, encourage and persuade the U.S. government to enact specific policies that create a strong, enduring, and mutually beneficial relationship with our ally, Israel. In the 2012 election, AIPAC donated $15 million to the federal election campaigns of U.S. candidates. In 2016, that's estimated to have shot up to $17 million. During the same year, Clinton's campaign also received more than $10 million from Israeli-American billionaire and political financier Haim Saban. In a leaked letter to Saban, Clinton highlighted she intended to fight specifically on the issue of BDS, the Palestinian-led campaign to boycott Israel, an issue Saban was particularly concerned about. Clinton also highlighted this issue in her AIPAC speech.
As I wrote last year in a letter to the heads of major American Jewish organizations, we have to be united in fighting back against BDS. Many of its proponents have demonized Israeli scientists and intellectuals, even students.
Clinton wasn't the only one speaking at this conference. Then Vice President Joe Biden did as well.
The CEO, past, present, and future, Howard Kaur, he was moving folks through the photo line, and a couple, like, he was like acting like he's moving me too quickly. And I said, don't worry, he's been giving me orders for years and years.
According to the nonprofit organization Open Secrets, campaign contributions from political action committees with pro-Israel missions like APAC's United Democracy Project amounted to more than $210 million between 1989 and 2021. Hillary Clinton received more than $2 million during that time. Joe Biden has received more than $4 million, the highest of any member of Congress. Today, Biden's administration continues to stand firmly against calls for a ceasefire in Gaza, even as the policy grows more and more unpopular among U.S. voters.
October, you had referred to the fact that the administration is not drawing any red lines for Israel. As the death toll for civilians in the Gaza Strip has gone up, I wanted to ensure, is that still the case, that the administration has no red lines at all?
That is still the case.
Early this week, U.S. Congress voted to censure Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian representative, after she called for a ceasefire and took part in pro-Palestinian actions.
The cries of the Palestinian and Palestinian and Israeli children sound no different to me. What I don't understand is why the cries of Palestinians sound different to you all.
Of those who voted for the motion, 22 were members of her own party, the majority of whom had received campaign contributions from APAC worth tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars. In the Florida House of Representatives this week, State Representative Angie Nixon attempted to put a resolution forward calling for a ceasefire. She was shouted down by her colleagues.
We are at 10,000 dead Palestinians. How many will be enough? I also, one of my colleagues just said all of them. Wow. One of my colleagues said all of them. One of my colleagues also stated that this is going to dry up their fundraising if we vote on this resolution. I also want that, like, that's what we've become in this state.
So where are we heading? When I interviewed Israeli journalist Orly Noy 2 weeks ago, as she and others were still reeling from the grief of the horrific attack on October 7 and watching in terror as the aftermath of Israel's unrestrained response unfolded in Gaza, she said something powerful about the relationship between the U.S. and Israel.
I think that the international community should own up to its own role in giving the green light to Israel to believe that it can be an apartheid regime to keep so many millions of people under oppression and still be accepted in the international community as a democracy. No more, no more. We cannot allow that anymore. Friends don't allow friends to drive drunk. I think that it applies here precisely. We've had a drunk leadership, drunk with power, for such a long time. Somebody needs to take the wheel from their hands.
Israel relies heavily on political and military support from the United States. And in return, U.S. politicians benefit from campaign contributions from Israeli lobby groups. This creates an echo chamber of political and personal interests that at best blinds public figures from seeing the conflict with a clear view, and at worst transforms them into voices speaking on behalf of Israel, parroting Israeli talking points and shielding its government from criticism abroad. If the lawmakers responsible for arming Israeli forces, who just days ago voted overwhelmingly in support of a $14 billion military aid package, if they aren't willing to pull their ally from the brink, then who can? And with the scale of destruction in Gaza spiraling, with its people trapped and helpless, and with no political solutions on the table, what then is the logical endpoint? This episode of The Big Picture is produced by me, Mohammed Hassan, for Middle East Eye. Thank you to Hossam Sarhan for filming and Anas Ala for graphics. And thanks to you for listening. You can also watch all of our episodes in video format on our YouTube channel. If you like this, please consider giving us a rating because it goes a long way and helps us reach new audiences.